You're listening to the Two Tongues Podcast. And now your hosts, Kyle and Chris.
Good day, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Two Tongues Podcast. Getting back to a little bit of opinion scholarship again today on a little ditty called the Ashtavakra Gita. So we're getting into Hinduism here again. And I'm going to be critical of it this time, maybe for the first time on the podcast. I like to talk about what I like. So often when I bring these subjects up, I'm telling you guys about what I like the most about it. In this case, I think it's important to be critical and maybe say some things that aren't so good about it. So I might be heavy-handed in leading with that. It's not going to be all bad. So before I jump into this, I'll just remind everybody that the interest that I've had in Hinduism really stems from the Upanishads. We have talked about the Rig Veda. We read creation myths from Hinduism. I think it's very interesting because the religion is so old. You know, it's the most ancient, continuously practiced religion in the world. It dates back to our Proto-Indo-European ancestors, deep, deep into prehistory. It's fucking interesting, right? But what I like the most about it is the philosophy that comes out of what they call Vedanta, which comes out of a book called the Upanishads. Not the Vedas exactly, but the end of the Vedas, the Upanishads. So you might think about the way the Bible ends with the book of Revelation. It's kind of like that. This is the cornerstone. This is the final bit of the story. And it consolidates and illuminates the entire message. And so what I like the most about that is the way in which the Upanishads talk about God. Hinduism, as you guys know, is a polytheistic religion with countless gods, understood in the way that the classical religions understood gods, with some differences. But then there's this higher level understanding which takes the form of a kind of trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, the creator, the destroyer, and the preserver of the cosmos, of reality. Mm-hmm. And Brahma is at the top of that hierarchy. Brahma is the high god, you might say, the god that all of the other gods roll up to. And you might also say the god from which all of the other gods descended. You know, they're all different aspects of the one god. And so there's a hint of monotheism in it, and I like that, you know. I'm a radical monotheist. And I have interesting ways of justifying that, but the Upanishads talk about this in a way that's connected with this idea of consciousness. And for those people who are, you know, mystically minded, the psychonauts out there and many of the Eastern religious aficionados understand what I mean when I talk about connecting the idea of creation or of God to the idea of sentience or consciousness or awareness. That took form in the Upanishads, also among a spiritual leader in ancient India called Shankara, and we've talked a little bit about Shankara in the past. And the school of Hinduism that he represents is called Advaita Vedanta, and that means non-dual. Okay, and the idea is that our consciousness, our awareness, and the awareness that they believe is the bedrock of material reality, the ones and zeros behind the matrix, the T-1000 liquid metal can become anything, the analogy that I always use, the thing that is ultimate reality behind the world of perceptions, the noumena, whatever that is, that ultimately it's indistinct, that thing I'm calling God is indistinct from our own consciousness. And not just our awareness. You know, like what's looking out from my eyes right now, what's observing right now. Not just that, but material reality itself. Time and space and the laws of physics and all of that. It's indistinct from the thing that we call God. It's non-dual. Everything is one. And this is a message you hear from mystics, religious mystics and psychedelic mystics and everything in between. I like that. I like the Upanishads. I like Shankara. I like Advaita Vedanta. It resonates with my own intuition. It corresponds to my own mystic experience. What I want to discuss today is a book called the Ashtavakra Gita. A good friend of mine in the show, Daniel Torridon of the Onion Unlimited podcast, brought this to my attention. It's a relatively easy read. He wanted me to give it a read, so I did. And it focuses on this non-dualism philosophy, that same thing that you see from Shankara and the Advaita Vedanta school. Just to give you a little bit of historical background, first of all, the copy of the book that I read, I don't read Sanskrit, I'm far from a linguistic scholar, so I read a translation by a gentleman named Dr. Thomas Byram that was published in 1990, and this is really a dialogue. So you can think about the Platonic dialogues. It's like a conversation that's happening between two people. Dr. Byram kind of stripped the translation of who was speaking and who was answering, and so it reads more like poetry. But it doesn't really take anything away. In fact, it I think maybe even makes it more powerful, because that's how the message is meant to be experienced. So a couple things historically about this particular Gita. It's old. Okay, it was written anonymously, and that's generally the case. Like, if you want to know who wrote the Vedas, good luck. If you want to know who wrote the Bhagavad Gita, if you want to know who wrote the Puranas, I mean, good luck. They're written anonymously, kind of like in the Bible we have the Psalms, and they're attributed to King David, but really they're anonymously written. The Ashtavakra Gita does not claim to be part of any collection of scriptures. It's not part of the Vedas. It's not part of the Puranas. But it is ancient, and it's filled with interesting shit. Okay, I'll put it that way. It stands alone. Okay, it's a work in and of itself. Now, the dating of it is controversial. Some scholars place it around 600 BC, so very ancient, which is just after the Bhagavad Gita was written. Others claim it was written by followers of Shankara himself, so much later on, in the 8th century AD. Could be any time in there. And the people that are talking in the Ashtavakra Gita are a sage, a wise man, Mahabharata, I believe, is his name, and then a king named Janaka. And Janaka is a king mentioned in the Vedas, so they're like recycling characters from the scriptures, the already known holy books. And it focuses on the nature of the self. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Hinduism or the Upanishads, that may be a confusing thing. It's like, whose self? Yourself? Myself? What do you mean? Self with a capital S. Okay, and this is the idea that the consciousness that is God is the self with a capital S. The reason the word self is used and not merely the word God is because it relates to our own identity. It relates, we are, at the deepest level, indistinct from the self with a capital S. What we think of as ourselves, what animates us and makes us exist, our being, is identical to God. So the self and our self are connected intimately. And again, they call it a radical version of non-dual philosophy, akin to Advaita Vedanta, but again, I'm going to challenge some things in it. And this non-dual philosophy is another philosophical word for non-dual is monism. And there are various types of monism. I'm trying to think of the philosopher's name, Russell. It's not coming to me. There's a type of philosophy called Russellian monism. This is going to come up in many ways in philosophy and in religion, but it just means oneness. Everything is one. A monad, one thing. Reality is one thing. All right, enough background. What I want to do next is I want to read to you the scriptures. I want to read to you the Ashtavakra Gita in a highly annotated sense. So you're going to get a flavor for the whole book, but I'm not going to read to you everything. I'm going to read it to you the way that I found it to be the most powerful. So hopping around a little bit with a couple things switched around in different orders. So without further ado, let me just jump into this. It says, if you wish to be free, shun the poison of the senses. Seek truth, love, and forgiveness. If you wish to be free, know you are the self, the witness of all these. Set your body aside. Sit in your own awareness. Okay, so that just gives you a flavor of how this opens. When he says, shun the poison of your senses, this is going to be a very fundamental recurring theme in this non-dual philosophy, certainly in the Ashtavakra Gita. Why are the senses poison? What does he mean by that? So he's making a distinction in philosophy, especially in idealism, we talk about this all the time, that there's something different about the world of appearances, the way things seem, and the way things are. So Immanuel Kant talked about the noumena, right, versus the world of appearances. The noumena is the real reality that's there. The world of appearances is only what we see. So there's some sort of a veil between them. And this is easy enough to understand. You know, when you experience the world, you have no way of knowing what other people experience. But even so, you know there are things you can't experience. There's more to the world than you can experience. You're not capturing everything. I don't know what's going on in the experience of others. There's a big gap there. I'm an island universe. On the other hand, there's things happening on the microscopic level, on the subatomic level. There's wavelengths of light in the ultraviolet various sides of the spectrum that aren't visible. There's all kinds of things happening that I don't have access to. So how can I say I understand the world at all? I have some very, very fractured, minuscule glimpse into it. So the world of appearances is not the same as the reality of the world. And a good, good pop culture way of understanding this is the movie The Matrix. You know, it could be, and simulation theory and modern science gives, you know, some freaky reasons to think this. There might be something true about this. That in The Matrix, we're living in this world of appearances. And what's real in the world isn't what we see and experience. It's the ones and zeros behind it that are generating it. So there's a difference between the noumenous, the ones and zeros, whatever the real bedrock reality is, and the things that you experience. So shun the poison of the senses, because that's leading you away from the truth. It's distracting you, right? There's something real going on that your senses aren't allowing you to see. If you trust them, you're going to go astray. So shun the poison of your senses. Then he says, seek truth, love, and forgiveness, which can't argue with. I think all human beings seek truth and love. And the love and forgiveness bit reminds me so much of Christianity, its fundamental goals of Christianity. That resonates with me as a Christian. And then it says, if you want to be free, know that you are the self. So this idea of being free is to be free from the illusion that the poison of your senses is setting before you. To be free of that illusion, to know the truth. And the truth is that you are the self, with a capital S. You are God itself. The witness of all these, that which experiences. And this is a critical idea. Close your eyes and imagine that everything that sees out of a set of eyes, everything that smells out of a nose or a smelling mechanism, everything that feels with fingers or tentacles, everything with which echolocates, everything which experiences electromagnetism, all of these experiences, that is the knower, okay? Whether it's you or me or a long dead person or an alien in some faraway part of the cosmos, the knower, that which is experiencing behind our eyes, that is the same in you and me and everything. The blade of grass, you know, the atoms that are bouncing around off of each other. All of these experiences, the thing that's doing the experiencing is God, right? That is how you are the self. If that makes sense. the witness of all these, that which witnesses your consciousness, is the consciousness, and that thing is God. And then he says something that might remind you of the Gnostics. It might remind you of Gnosticism. He says, set your body aside. Sit in your own awareness. And this reminds me of a common practice in the East, meditation, right? You're sitting down, you're clearing your mind, and what you're aware of then isn't thoughts, right? Because you're pushing those away. It's not sensations because you're pushing those away. It's just pure awareness. It's the thing that's left when you've cleared your mind of all sensation and all thoughts, when you try to get to absolute nothingness and you realize it isn't nothingness. There's something still there, and that is this baseline awareness, something in you that's ready to have an experience at any moment. Sit in that awareness, right? Forget about your body. Focus on that awareness. You know, that's the God part of you that you're experiencing. So it's important to set your body aside. You know, the Ashtavakra Gita also says in another place, you are not your body. Your body is not you. And this is a very Gnostic idea. The early Christians were full of these Gnostic groups that believed that the material world and the body were sinful, that they needed to be purified, because what's good in you is the spirit, the divine thing. And this meat vehicle you're riding around in is full of, suffering and addiction and lust and anger and all these things that aren't good, right? So your body is evil. You have to set it aside. You have to get out from under your desires. You got to get out from under your weaknesses, because those things are keeping you from the spiritual essence of becoming closer to God, something like that. And you get an echo of this here. Set your body aside. You are not your body. And it's very difficult to say something like that. You are not your body. We identify with our bodies, our faces, our memories, all of that. But that's not you, says the Gita. You are something else. You are that awareness that's left over when you've forgotten everything else. That thing, that's what you are. All right, I'll go on. He says, if you see yourself as separate, you are bound. No, you are one. You are awareness itself. Just as a coil of rope is mistaken for a snake, so you are mistaken for the world. The self looks like the world, but this is just an illusion. Whatever takes form is false. Only the formless endures. All right, so you get some interesting echoes of ancient Greek religion, pre-Socratic Greek philosophy, and certainly Hinduism and Buddhism and some Eastern ideas, that what God is formless and eternal, the unknowable, something like that. He says, if you see yourself as separate, you are bound. Right? Remember, if what you are is awareness, pure awareness, and this is the bedrock of reality, what everything is built from, all of the material cosmos, and every conscious being, you know, behind them is the same awareness, the same spirit, God itself, then you aren't separate from anything else. You're one, right? The illusion is the separateness. The reality is the oneness, the unity. So he says, if you see yourself as separate, you are bound. Bound to what? Bound to the illusion. Right, bound to the veil, the inability to recognize what you really are. And so he reminds us, no, you are one. You are awareness itself. Okay, just as a coil of a rope laying on the ground, you might think, oh shit, that's a snake. He says, just in that same way, you are mistaken for the world. The self looks like the world. Now let me put that differently. God looks like the world. And this understanding, this is why mystics cannot be atheists. Because once you realize that God looks like the world, you can no longer deny God exists. You're confronted with God every second of your life, and every experience, and every encounter, and everything you do and are. He says, but this is just an illusion. Whatever takes form is false. The world is false. The truth behind the world, that is the only formless thing that endures. He says, when you understand the truth of this teaching, you will not be born again. Okay, I love this. Obviously, the word born again as a Christian reminds me of my own Christian upbringing. To be born again is part of the Christian experience, part of the salvation, to be born from the Spirit and from fire. That's what Jesus says. And I think this is sort of, it sounds like the opposite to the promise of Christianity. He says, when you understand the truth of this teaching, you will not be born again. Right? Where Christianity promises you that you will be born again. And the idea here, obviously you have to understand that Hinduism is talking about the cycle of reincarnation, the karmic cycle. So what salvation is in a Hindu perspective is to finally transcend this cycle of births and deaths and rebirths, right? So to not be born again is to not be reincarnated, is not to have to go through this process again, but to finally transcend and be something greater. And if you understand the truth of the Ashtavakra Gita, you will not be born again. You will transcend reincarnation. And while we're talking about the Gnostics, which we brought up earlier, I think this sentence is just like eerily similar to one of the oldest Gnostic Gospels, maybe even the earliest Gospel period, a Gospel called the Gospel of Thomas. So again, let me just read this line, then I'll read the Gospel of Thomas version so you can get the full effect. The Ashtavakra Gita says, when you understand the truth of this teaching, you will not be born again. Gospel of Thomas says, whoever finds the interpretation of these sayings will not experience death. Coincidence? I don't know, but pretty interesting, right? All right, lastly, it says, God is infinite within the body and without, like a mirror and the image in a mirror. Right? So this is how the self looks like the world, right? He says, God is infinite within the body and without. It's everything, right? Like a mirror in the image in a mirror. Now, I find this interesting for a couple of reasons. This language, that God is within the body and without, reminds me again of the Gospel of Thomas, which says something similar but not identical to the canonical Gospels in the Bible. It says, the kingdom of God is inside you, and it is outside of you. Right, the body, within the body and without. The kingdom of God is inside you and outside you. So again, another resonance with the Gnostic Christians. I find it to be interesting. The canonical Gospels say something like this, the kingdom of God is within you. They don't say it's without, it's outside of you. They just leave it at it's within you. But the Gnostics said the kingdom of God is within you and it is outside of you. And then this idea of like a mirror and the image in a mirror. It's like what that image in the mirror is reflecting is the true thing, the ones and zeros behind the matrix, the bedrock of reality, the fundamental thing, God itself. The image in the mirror isn't exactly God itself. It's the reflection of God. And see, that is how the world is. The world is something like a reflection of the real reality, the real thing that God is. God is the only real thing, right? Non-dual. It's the only real thing. And I find this interesting because when I had my own mystical experience, I said something quite like this. I was thinking about this in that mystical state of mind, and I said that reality is like God looking in the mirror. I mean, word for word. All right, that brings me to the next bit here. He says, as a wave is only water, so creation is only the self. When the self is unknown, the world arises. From me, the world streams out, and in me it dissolves. Okay, so there's a bunch of interesting stuff here too. As a wave is only water, so creation is only the self. This is just like the mirror idea, just like how the self looks like the world. This is something like that. A wave is only water. So the reality of the wave is water. even though the wave may be distinct from the deepness of the ocean, which is an analogy that is used a lot in Hinduism, that God or the bedrock of being is the silent stillness of the deep, and all of the a world of experience and perception is the motion at the just on the surface, right? All of the transformation that's happening on the surface, the waves, that's what we experience. But our reality is the deepness underneath it. We think only the waves exist. That's what we assume, because that's what we see. But the truth is, we're much deeper than that, infinitely deeper than that. All right, he says, when the self is unknown, the world arises. What he means is, when you don't know that you are the self, when you don't understand, you haven't had that revelation, realize that you are God, then the world arises. So there's this dissociation idea. Like, you dissociate yourself from God, from the thing that you are, and then you see God as something different from you. And this idea of separation in that way is exactly what we see in most of the creation myths in the ancient world. Certainly in the Bible, the heavens are separated from the earth, light is separated from darkness, the female is separated from Adam, right? It's the separation that constitutes the world. And then he reminds you, from me the world streams out, and in me it dissolves. Ultimately, the world is God. It's one thing. He says, I have taken form, but I am still one. Right? This is that old philosophical idea of the one and the many. How can fundamental reality be a unity if when I look out and I experience things, they seem like many independent standalone things? The world, the sun, the moon, the people, the trees, it's all different, right? It's all distinct from each other. See, that's the illusion. It says God has taken form, but is still one. And you get some echoes of the Trinity in that, right? God is many and one. So we have this idea even in Christianity. Then he says, I am not the knower, nor the known, nor the knowing. These three are not real. They only seem to be when I am not known. Two from one, this is the root of suffering. Only perceive that all the world is false. There is no other remedy. So this is focusing a lot on the illusion aspect of reality. But some interesting stuff here. He says, I am not the knower, the known, or the knowing. And I have some objections to this because the idea of God, the self, and awareness are so closely connected. I don't know how you can separate the idea of awareness or consciousness from subject and object, from the known and the knower and the knowing. I don't know how you can separate that. But I think what he's trying to say here is something interesting that I want to just point out. That the Hindus make a distinction between consciousness, like our normal perceptions, and the experience of awareness, right? So remember when I was talking about meditating and clearing your mind of everything, no sensations, no thoughts, and you notice that you haven't created nothing. There's still something that you can't get rid of. That's just a baseline pure awareness. And that is the sacred thing. That's the thing that can't be done away with. It's the fundamental thing. Now, pure awareness in that state is something all by itself. Now, it may be the thing that experiences, and so that when there's something to experience, something to be known, and a process of knowing involved, awareness is what's doing that. But it's not the same thing, right? To say that consciousness is the process of knowing isn't quite right. This awareness is something else. And they say that it is still and unchanging and eternal, much like the Taoists talk about the Tao. And so thoughts are always changing, right? You know, they're sequential, they're temporal, and your thoughts change from one topic to the next, or they evolve in ways. There's always motion and transformation happening in knowing, but not in awareness. So this is the distinction that's being made. God is not the knower or the known, right? Not the subject or the object or the knowing. These are not real. They're part of the illusion, you see. He says they only seem to be real when I am not known. They only seem to be real when you don't realize that all is one. And he says that two from one, this is the root of suffering. to understand, to be convinced of the multiplicity of the world without understanding the underlying unity. That is the root of suffering. He says, only perceive that all the world is false. There is no other remedy. So he's basically begging you to recognize the illusion of perception, that the world is not what it seems. He says, I am the unbounded deep in whom all living things arise. I am the unbounded deep in whom the waves of all the worlds rise and fall. But I do not rise and fall. Beyond all form, forever still. Even so am I. Whew, goosebumps, baby. So when he says, I am the unbounded deep, I can't help but think of the beginning chapters of Genesis where it says that the Spirit of God was on the surface of the deep, and God is called I Am, right? And here he says, even so am I, right? Even so I am. The unbounded deep is the thing that is fundamental reality. So I like this this analogy that's used, the unbounded deep. I see parallels in that with the Bible, but also other mythological traditions. It's representative of this deep, bottomless fount of potential, that from which anything can arise, the unbounded deep. That's the creative font, right, of being. The unbounded deep in whom the waves of all the worlds rise and fall. Damn. He says, but I do not rise and fall, right? This is back to the analogy of the waves at the top of the ocean. The unbounded deep is still and formless forever. It's just that activity happening at the surface, right? He says, I do not rise and fall. I am the boundless deep. All right, that brings me to the next bit. He says, from ignorance of the self, desire arises. The man who is wise knows himself in all things, and all things in himself. He watches his own actions as if they were another's. He sees this world is a mirage, and he no longer wonders about it. How can he fear the approach of death? All right, interesting, right? From ignorance of the self, desire arises. Okay, this is interesting because desire implies that you want something you don't already have. You want something else, right? But ignorance of the self means this idea of multiplicity. It means ignorance that you don't realize. You are one. You are one with everything. And so in a sense, everything already is you. If you know that, what can you possibly desire? Everything is already you. What more can you want? There is nothing more. So this is the idea. From ignorance of the self, desire arises. It's when you think there's something apart from you that makes you want it. That's where desire arises. And ultimately, I ask, desire for what? And it's something like, all right, so I relate this to a philosopher named Schopenhauer. He talks about the human condition, and he uses this phrase, restlessly striving. You see, when you would look at human beings, we're never happy or at least satisfied for long. We always want more. We always want something else. That's it characterizes human beings to be restlessly striving. And I think it means something like your mind or your heart desires that which is beyond everything. It desires that place where all desires vanish, where you can finally be quenched, you can finally be satisfied. And I think it might be something like an unconscious instinct to return to this perfect unity that we are already. The revelation, the spiritual or mystical experience, is the unveiling. It's the realizing that. It's not something that happens to you. It's realizing what you already are. It's a longing to be the ultimate. Now, because that awareness of unity is unconscious, we don't really know that. We don't really understand that. we try to satisfy that longing with all kinds of insufficient substitutes, with pleasures of all kinds. And what we're really trying to fill, that void that we can never fill, it's like I'm thinking of the child's toy where you're plugging in shapes, blocks of shapes into holes. You need that to find that unique shape that actually fills that void. And the only thing that does that is the knowledge, is the recognition that you are God. He says, the man who is wise knows himself and all things in himself. If you know that, what can you possibly desire? It says, he watches his own actions as if they were another's. And this is an interesting thing. This is identifying with the awareness part of you and seeing everything else about you as part of the illusion that the cosmos and the world is. You look at yourself almost like you're watching yourself, like you've come out of your body and you're watching yourself act like an actor on a stage. He watches his own actions as if they were another's. He sees this world as a mirage, right? This is part of the illusion, and he no longer wonders about it. He's like, of course it's an illusion. And then he says something interesting. How can he fear the approach of death, right? So the idea is somebody who knows himself as the self with a capital S, someone who knows he is God, how can he fear death? The Ashtavakra Gita also says it in one point, you and the world are one. You cannot change or die. This is what he means. You are God, and God is eternal. And it reminds me of the promise of eternal life in Christianity. Right? Remember the Gospel of Thomas quote we read earlier? He who understands the interpretations of these sayings will not taste death. Or John 3:16, God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, right? Whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. This is the promise of Christianity, and you see the echo of it here. How can you fear the approach of death when you know this great secret, this great truth? All right, this brings me to the next section. It says, the true seeker feels no elation, even in the exalted state which Indra and all the gods unhappily long for. His heart is not smudged by right or wrong. He knows the world is only the self. He knows he is the self, the Lord of all creation. All right, so I find this particularly interesting, kind of both parts of this. When he says the true seeker feels no elation, even in the exalted state. So I take this to mean that mystical experience, that pinnacle moment where you recognize you have that revelatory unveiling and you recognize that you are one with eternity. When your identity suddenly is shared with the thing you generally call God. When you have that moment. Some people reach that moment through meditation, some through psychedelic drugs, and you know, some through sensory deprivation or sleep deprivation or ecstatic ritual or whatever. This is a human experience that's possible. When you have this exalted state, you feel no elation. It's not like you're pleased about it because the you that would be pleased is not part of that experience. You become the experience. You become God. And this is the interesting bit. He says, this exalted state, which Indra and all the gods unhappily long for. Now, this is a telltale sign of the complexity of Hinduism. Right? Indra is the high god in the Rig Veda, the god of the sky, the god of order. But it's not just him. Him and all the gods long for this exalted state, this oneness experience. And it says that they unhappily long for it. It implies that even the gods, even the existence of superhuman, supernatural beings, if we can make room for that in our cosmology, that even they want the same experience that a human being can possibly have, this mystical unity. And they long for it unhappily, which implies that they struggle or cannot achieve that experience. And I can't help but think about the story of the Buddha who was a Hindu, by the way, who meditates under the Bodhi tree, reaches enlightenment. And as the story goes, the Hindu gods or devas or whatever it is, demons, are actually trying to actively stop him from transcending, from reaching nirvana. They see it's happening and they try to actively stop him. They're like, fuck no! Like they're unhappy about it. What is that? It's saying that there's something in human experience that is higher even than the gods, right? There is a God with a capital G, a self with a capital S, that is above even the gods with a lowercase g. It also implies that the consciousness or awareness within us, the thing that animates us, you know, the knower within us, if gods exist with a lowercase g and are conscious and aware like us, they have the same potential within us that we have. And we have the ability to transcend even the gods, as the Buddha did. It's amazing. All right, he says, his heart is not smudged by right or wrong. And we'll see that again in another place. And just to be brief, his heart is not smudged by right or wrong means that he's transcended right or wrong. Right? So that which is everything. It's like the union of opposites, everything combined, right? Everything that possibly exists or could exist merged into one thing, including right and wrong. When you put those things together, you transcend either one. And so God is something like that transcends all opposites. So his heart is not smudged by right or wrong. He knows the whole world is only the self, and he knows he is the self, the Lord of all creation. Now, if you're a Christian or a Jew or something and you're listening to this, that might seem like a blasphemous thing to say. I understand. The first time I had this idea, this thought, I am God, I was very reluctant to think it, and I was certainly reluctant to say it. And when I finally was able to say it, it was awkward and difficult, and it took me a long time of repeating it to be able to be comfortable saying it. He knows he is the self, the Lord of all creation. And as strange as that might sound to a Christian or a monotheist, in chapter 10 of John, Jesus says something like this. He says, I and the Father are one. He is the self, Lord of all creation. I and the Father are one. Now, if you can take this Christian idea that Jesus and God are essentially one, and you can extend that in a Hindu fashion, like we're reading here, to everything. Everything and the Father are one. And you start to understand the picture. You also start to see how everything is divine, how there's a certain morality that comes from that. If everything is you and everything is divine, you should treat others as yourself. In fact, you should treat others as God. And then I get images of Jesus washing the dirt off of his apostles' feet. You're treating others as if they're God because they are God. And you are too. All right, we're getting towards the end here, but another couple brief bits, and they kind of get better as we go along to conclude. It goes like this. When the mind is attracted to anything, you are bound. When there is no I, you are free. Wherever there is desire, there is the world. Desire binds you. Destroy it, and you are free. Nothing lasts. Nothing is real. It is all suffering. Give it up. Give up the illusion. Give up the world. Let it all go, the body and the mind. Let yourself dissolve. You are already fulfilled. Let yourself dissolve. Man, oh man, you see what I mean about the poetry? Let yourself dissolve. So we're focusing a lot on this idea of the world being illusion and the attachments we have to the world and trying to break those attachments and break the desire that causes the attachments. So he says, when the mind is attracted to anything, when it wants anything, you are bound to the illusion. Where there is no I, where there is no sense of being an individual or being a self, you are free. Wherever there is desire, there is the world, right? Your desire attaches you to the illusion. He says, desire binds you. And then he tells you what to do about it. Destroy it. Give it up. Give up the illusion. Give up the world. Let it all go, the body and the mind. Let yourself dissolve. And I see things like Jesus telling his apostles to throw down their nets and follow him, to sell all their possessions and follow him, to give up the attachments, to give up the world. I see an echo of that. Something about those attachments to things is an attachment to otherness. It's a obstacle in the way of recognizing the underlying unity that's there. This is why I think Jesus made that remark about it being more difficult for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. And then it says, let yourself dissolve, which he says twice. He says, you are already fulfilled. Let yourself dissolve. Now, I can't help but relate let yourself dissolve to this idea of an ego death. And this is what people, especially those who have a psychedelic mystical experience, talk about. This feeling of dying to themselves, which is again another very Christian notion, to die to yourself and be born again. This is what a mystical experience feels like. And when the ego dies, when the thing that you attach yourself to, the thing that's attached to your face and your memories and your experience and your body, your desires and your thoughts, when that thing is gone away with, when it's done away with, then you realize that you aren't any of those things. All the things you thought you were, at the deepest level, you aren't. But you're not nothing. You're something else. There's something left. There's something there. That's this unifying consciousness. That's the one with the universe experience the hippies tell you about. You are already fulfilled. You already have everything. You can't possibly need anything. You already are everything. So let yourself dissolve. I think this passage gives the most intense but also negative, I think, sense of the desire to get rid of the illusion, to get beyond the illusion, because it says, desire binds you. Destroy it. Nothing lasts. Nothing is real. It is all suffering. Give it up. Give up the illusion. Give up the world. Let it all go. Let yourself dissolve. It's scary. It seems scary. I think there's things about this that are important and true, and things about this that, well, I'll save it for the end, but I object to. All right, two more. He has gone beyond the bounds of human nature. Right? This is somebody who's had that mystical experience, that's felt the unity, that has the revelation, they are God. He has gone beyond the bounds of human nature. Nothing disturbs him. Nothing surprises him. Because he is free, he neither craves nor disdains the things of the world. He takes them as they come. His mind is always detached. His mind is empty. He is not concerned with the struggle between good and evil. He is beyond all. He knows there is nothing. Whatever he does nothing. All right, so all this stuff about there being nothing, it's sort of true and not true, because we know that the thing he's calling nothing, he's also calling illusion, right? The world is illusion. It is nothing because it's false, but it's not nothing in the sense of no thing. It is a thing. It's just a false thing. He knows there is nothing. And then he says whatever he does nothing. But at another point in the Ashtavakra Gita, it explains what he means by he does nothing. And this is a confusing thing to me, because even in the Taoist tradition, they say things like do without doing, you know, and it's like, what does that mean? But the Ashtavakra Gita clarifies this. He says at some point in the scripture, the body does this, not I. Right? The body does this, not I. With these thoughts, whatever he does nothing. Okay, so it's the body that acts. Remember that passage earlier where it's talking about coming outside yourself and watching yourself act as though you're somebody else. It has to do with understanding that you're not attached to that thing. That's your body or your thoughts or your memories or whatever. You're something beyond that. You're the awareness beyond that. So God doesn't act, right? The body acts, but the deepest part of you is not doing the acting. So when it says whatever he does nothing, I think that's what he really means. The action in the world is part of the illusion. So you could call it nothing. There's also things about this that are interesting. It's like the enlightened man, right? The person that's gone beyond the bounds of human nature. Nothing disturbs him. Nothing surprises him. Okay, maybe. He neither craves nor disdains the things of the world. Okay, again, if you believed that you truly are already everything and everyone, there's nothing that you want, so you're not going to crave anything. That makes sense. His mind is always detached. See, I'm not really sure I can go with that. His mind is detached. His mind is empty. Is that necessary? Like, I don't really understand that. And then here's the kicker. He is not concerned with the struggle between good and evil. So we talked about God being the unity of things, the union of opposites. So good and evil taken together, rather than good and evil by themselves. There isn't the separation in God. God is the unity. So good and evil aren't separate things in God. So he's not concerned with the struggle between good and evil, but I don't think that that is a call to not act in the world, like where it says, whatever he does nothing. I don't think it's a call not to act in the world. I don't think it's a call not to gravitate towards the good or even express your will in the world towards the good. And I think it could be interpreted that way. Like, I don't have to do anything. I can watch people get murdered and raped and watch the world burn and stand there like a saint in meditation. I don't think that is right. And I think there are some believers in Hinduism and Buddhism that may say that. I don't think that's the right way of understanding this. I'm not sure the Ashtavakra Gita is doing justice to the truth of the intuitions of mystical experience when it says things like this, and it's certainly possible that it's over my head. Certainly possible I'm not understanding it. But I think that interpretation is wrong. All right, the last quote for the day. It says, "Awaken to your own nature, and all delusions melt like a dream. The world is nothing. It is only an idea. The self lives forever. Everything else is imagination. When you know you are God, what is there left to know or to say or to do? For the self is everything. Men try all kinds of paths, but they overlook the self. Because the fool wants to become God, he never finds him. The master is already God, without ever wishing to be. He has given up the duality of the world which arises with the mind. He neither praises the peaceful nor blames the wicked." All right, so a couple things here. So Advaita Vedanta and non-dual philosophy, it's in the East. It's largely this religious sort of thing. In the West, it's largely a philosophical thing. You think about people like Hegel, as an example, or Bradley. They say things like the world of perception is something that exists only in the mind. Very much like what Plato talks about. The world of forms, that's the numinous thing, the world of ideas. And so you see a parallel to Plato here. The world is nothing, it is only an idea. I think that's interesting. Everything else is imagination. Remember that bit earlier about the world of perception being God's dream, right? Everything else is imagination. And he says, when you know you are God, what is there left to know or to do? Right? And this, I think, relates back to this earlier point about whatever he does nothing. Right? He who knows he's God, what is there left to do? For the self is everything. I think this is misleading. I think there is something left to do. I think our actions in the world create experiences, and they also shape the world and shape the potential for future experiences. What we do is critically important because we are God, and as God, we are shaping the world. We are creating the world. So what we do is significant. How we express our will is significant and even divine. And it can be used for evil. It can be used in a way that's not helpful, that destroys. And part of the Hindu reality is Shiva, the god of destruction, that destruction is necessary for new things to come. And so we have both possibilities, the creative and the destructive. And then he says, all men try all sorts of paths, but they overlook the self, right? The person who is on the path, who wants to have this unitive experience and realize they are God, but have the experience themselves. You know, the person who wants that will try anything it can think of to achieve that, but never find it. And this is like the, you know, they say in all sorts of scriptures that this experience is not something that can be taught. You're not going to find it in a holy book. It's an experience that you have to have. And wanting it is not enough. Reading scripture is not enough. Meditating, praying is not enough. And they say that in the Ashtavakra Gita as well, that meditation is superfluous, essentially. I think it's not entirely superfluous. I think prayer and meditation are important introductory steps. But you have to have, as they say in Christianity, the grace has to be given freely to you. It's not something you have control over. But once you have that experience, it says the duality of the world, which arises with the mind, goes away. And then it repeats this similar sentiment that we read earlier about not caring about the struggle between good and evil. It says, he neither praises the peaceful nor blames the wicked. I think there's something wrong there. I think God is a judge. And if we are God, again, we should be able to judge good and evil. We should be able to suggest what we want the world to be. We should be able to blame the wicked. And there's this detachment that's been emphasized. Detach yourself from the illusion. What's happening, the good and evil that are happening are in the world of illusion. Your experiences are in the world of illusion. They're not real. So don't bother yourself with them. Just try to be absorbed back into the pure awareness that is God, where you're fully self-satisfied. Something about that seems wrong. It seems cheap. It seems lazy. I don't think it's satisfaction that we want. If that were the case, we'd never get out of bed. We'd all just do heroin until we died. I don't think satisfaction is what we want. We want challenge. We want experience. We want novelty. Those are the things we remember. Those are the things we value. Those are the things that make up the scenes of our lives that flash before our eyes and at the moment of death. You know, those things. That's what we want. And that brings me to my conclusion. Okay. So as much as the philosophy of non-dualism resonates with my own intuitions, and as much as I believe the Upanishads and Advaita Vedanta have captured the truth of genuine mystic experience, I want to try to be critical here and as objective as possible. The truth is, the Ashtavakra Gita says many things I like, but others I'd like to challenge. For example, when describing God or the self with a capital S, I agree wholeheartedly. God is, as the Gita says, one, eternal, and formless, and is associated with the animating sentience in the world. It is awareness itself. Where we begin to diverge, however, is in the implications of these truths. The Gita says the self is not the world or the body. It is not the knower, the known, or the process of knowing. There is a stark division placed between what we might call the divine and the material, between the transcendent and the immanent. The Gita calls the material illusion and asks that we dismiss them in order to find the truth of our own reality. The world, as understood through sense perception, is harshly called delusion, poison, false, not real, and even nothing. as if there's nothing good in any of it. As if its existence serves no purpose but to bind us and keep us from realizing what we are. As if it serves no purpose at all. And for this reason, it shouldn't be engaged with. We should, quote, give it up. As the Gita says, even let our very selves dissolve. This attitude, I believe, is a mistake. It's too simple. Naive, even. It is missing the forest for the trees. You see, if we agree that awareness is bedrock reality, that it is the fundamental thing, and that the consciousness which exists in the world is, in fact, indistinct from it, then we have to ask ourselves, what is the nature we share with the self, with God? We recognize the primordial questions that perpetually occupy and fascinate human beings, the very things that myth, religion, philosophy, and science attempt to answer. What am I? What is the cosmos? What is the meaning of existence? We long to know ourselves and learn toward the answer through experience. By understanding the experience of being us, by experiencing the world and others, we get ever closer to the answer. So why should God not be occupied by this same yearning? Imagine for a second being infinite, eternal awareness with nothing yet created to experience. For eons you sit in the silence of yourself, aware, but aware of what? What would there be to be aware of? It's not nothing exactly, because there is awareness there. Awareness of awareness, perhaps. What thoughts might arise when faced with awareness of awareness? Might it be, what is this? Or, what am I? Would God not long to know itself? And there it is. There unfolds the answer to the meaning of existence. The self separated its own awareness from awareness itself, subject from object. And the world was born. The world, therefore, is the mechanism by which God gets to know itself, gets to experience the infinite glory that it is. It is that which transforms awareness in potential to a fractally unfolding actuality, which is nothing more, nothing other, than a mirror held up to the infinite, a representation, an image of God. The world lets God be God. It transcribes pure awareness into a living, moving self-experience. Now, you can call that illusion if you want, and you would not be wrong. But you'd be just as far away from the truth. The illusion is real. It is just as much God as transcendent awareness, and even inseparable and indispensable from it. Should we deny and dismiss that? Or should we love it with all our hearts? What say you?
Well, there you have it. That's one avenue explored, but infinitely more still to go. I hope you enjoyed thinking along with us. I know. It's not easy work. Thinking. It's hard and full of uncertainties, but I'm grateful for the company as we trek through this together. Here's to hoping that the juice is worth the squeeze. See what I did there? Let's find out together in the next episode.